And Korea was the only country in Asian history, in that part of Asia, that had never actually invaded another country. China, Russia, and Japan had regularly had interventions into the Korean territory. Actually, Japan considered Korea like a bridge to Asia for them. Only 100 miles separates Japan from Korea. And I thought, what an ironic twist that the only country that was not an aggressor nation was divided as a result of World War II and remains divided in 2003, with 10 million families divided by the partition line. And it always been presented as an ideological, a very clear-cut ideological division between the evil communists in the north and the democratic-loving Koreans in the south. And if you look at the governments, after the war was, and by the way, during the war, we destroyed every North Korean city through bombing. In the fall of 1950, General MacArthur issued an order to destroy every target, every village, every factory, every bridge, every dike, every dam in North Korea. It was an order MacArthur issued, which Curtis LeMay carried out with his 1,000 fleet bombers, day after day after day after day after day. In fact, Curtis LeMay said in 1952, we've bombed every city twice. We're going to now pulverize rocks into small stones. People lived in caves. Again, I say that the United States policies in our interventions, whether Korea, Vietnam, or elsewhere, I don't think can be completely understood without realizing just how racist a society we are. I don't think you can do these things unless there's a racism that's deeply embedded in our ethos, in our character. I hate to say it, but I do think it's a very tragic reality, a sickness that's part of our culture. It may not be unique to our culture, but it's something we have to contend with. Is a very serious explanation of why we can so easily go to other countries and bomb them and destroy entire societies without crying, without feeling remorse, without feeling sick. So I got more and more interested in telling the story about the history of Korea and the U.S. involvement because of this tragedy, which you could look at almost any country in Africa, Asia, or Latin America and come up with a pretty dark history of U.S. policy. It's the truth. You can pick your country and study it. But in Korea, like in Vietnam, 5 million were killed. Korea seemingly permanently divided. One of the major crimes of the 20th century still not resolved. What the United States did to Korea, what the United States did to Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, that is beyond the comprehension of most U.S. American people to grasp. What it's like to destroy ancient cultures, what it's like to pulverize societies into small pebbles and not feel the pain of that kind of inflicted damage on other people. I mean, after all, they're human beings. So I just think of Korea as a case study, as a metaphor, in a sense, for a whole history of our behavior, behavior that we have to examine, behavior that we have to look at in ourselves. What is it about us that can feel so comfortable while we're the only country that has troops in 150 other countries in the world? We control space, we control air spaces as well as outer space. We control the seas. We have 60% of all weapons of mass destruction that are in the world. We're the only nation that has used nuclear weapons. There is this notion that we feel exceptional. It's called exceptionalism in political science terms. And therefore, we feel justified in assessing evil from good and responding to the evil, because we're an exceptional society that is able to have an extraordinarily good judgment in distinguishing good versus evil and having these responses. Well, obviously, I don't believe that we're an exceptionally good society. We are exceptionally in denial. We are exceptionally spoiled. We are, in a sense, creating a globalized model of capitalism that will destroy the planet, destroy cultures, destroy the air, destroy the water, destroy the soil, destroy the human spirit. And yet we have, as human beings, the total capacity to break out of the box, to become fully human, transcending nation-state ideologies, transcending this notion of loyalty to the nation-state and citizenship when it means turning away from truth. The structural problem that we have to face is kind of ominous. We have 4.5% of the world's population, but we consume anywhere from 25% to 50% the world's resources, depending on the resource we look at. That requires theft at gunpoint. It requires an enforced unfairness in the distribution of resources. We can continue to do that believing that we deserve it, that we are worth more and they're worth less. But in fact, we are not worth more and they are not worth less. Nobody is. And as my Korean activists tell me, we haven't had our first real revolution yet in the United States. We had a revolution that we talk about, the American Revolution, but it was the Brits here against the Brits in England. It was to break free of monarchical rule for the people who had land in this country. It was not a revolution around class. And we still, as a society, don't acknowledge that we have a serious class problem in addition to a race problem. That we aren't able politically to deal honestly with class issues. It's called justice. So in a sense, I would say that Korea can teach us a lot by examining this history of our intervention in Korea. The Koreans can teach us a lot. By the way, since Han has been unleashed, this liberation of this repressed rage that started in 1999, everywhere people are starting to talk about their history in Korea. If you go to South Korea and you travel around the various communities, they're talking about what happened in 1945, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50 that they did not dare talk about. 1951, 52. Why was there a Korean War? Why did we decide June 25th was the start of the war? Why hadn't we talked about Syngman Rhee's incursions into the North over 12 or 1,400 times in 1949 and 50? Why does the United States insist on having 37,000 troops at 100 bases in South Korea? When you go to South Korea today, if you look at the armed forces station when you arrive in your living quarters, whether it's a hotel or a private residence, you'll notice on the armed forces channel every day they have warnings for tourists, places to avoid for that day. Places to avoid are where there are expected demonstrations by Koreans against U.S. military presence in Korea. You will see And then, of course, I look at that so I know where I am going to go that day. And you will see thousands of students, in some cases thousands of students, demonstrating in front of the bases with big signs in English, U.S. troops out of Korea. That's for the Western press. So you have this unleashing of Han, which after 50 years, people are starting to talk about their feelings, their anger, their desire for completion of some mystery that's happened in their life that they couldn't talk about, disappearances. That liberates energy for other things. It takes a lot of energy to repress feelings and to keep them in control. So you have that. And now you have the history books in Korea itself beginning to be uncensored. They've had as much of a censored version of history as we have here. And then you had the U.S. armored personnel carrier that ran over two Korean girls and killed them, for which the soldiers were exonerated. All of this produces a kind of convergence of energy in South Korea to get the U.S. out. And the solution to this Korean problem, quote-unquote problem, is very simple. And if it wasn't for the complication of U.S. politics, it would be resolved in a day. All the North Koreans want is a peace treaty. The Korean War ended with an armistice, cessation of hostilities pending a peace treaty. The peace talks were to go on in Panmunjom. Panmunjom still has the building where the talks went on until 1992. There's a yellow line halfway bisecting the building. Chairs on one side of the line, chairs on the other side of the line. North Koreans would sit on one side, representatives of the United States on the other side. They haven't met for 10 years or 11 years. But all North Korea wants is a peace treaty. And now, more than ever, they want a peace treaty as an alternative to war, because they've been told by the unelected resident of the White House, a person that the world addresses as president, who's not even elected, an amazing thing that we have an unelected person in the White House. I still think that is one incredible thing that we haven't really dealt with yet. We have an unelected person in the White House that we call president. He has identified North Korea as a member of the Axis of Evil. He has identified Korea as a potential target for preemptive strikes using nuclear weapons. If you were a country and had the biggest bully country in the world that had all these weapons of mass destruction targeting you, I wonder how you would feel and think, and whether you would be worrying about your future and defending yourself from that kind of attack. I've traveled all over North Korea, as well as I have South Korea, and I've talked with hundreds, if not thousands, of people, always with a translator, of course. But you know, they're people just like us. They laugh, they cry, they want security, they want peace. They don't want to fear when they're going to be bombed again. During the Korean War, one-third of all the population in North Korea was killed. One of the highest percentages of deaths in the history of the world in warfare. Everybody you meet in North Korea, everybody I've met in North Korea, everybody without exception, lost one or a dozen or 20 family members, and they can start talking about who and their family died in the bombings. It's a scar that hasn't been healed, and we've continued to demonize North Korea for various reasons, partly to maintain our justification for Star Wars, because Korea has missiles, we say, that can maybe hit the Aleutian Islands, part of the United States. We want to make sure that China continues to be surrounded. Even though we want their markets, we also fear China. they're all 1/4 of the world's population. It certainly helps justify continued escalated Pentagon budgets to have these enemies, Cuba, 90 miles off our shore, this big threat to us, 11 million people. Can you imagine that if the human species survives, archaeologists and anthropologists will be wondering, what on earth were these people thinking? What on earth were they doing? How could they have been so deranged as to have all these weapons of mass destruction, all this social decay, inattention to details of the well-being of its own citizenry, while it's planning to control space? It's since 1997 has this concept of full spectrum dominance. We want to dominate every spectrum of life. Wow, what an obsession we have. It's kind of like a mental illness. And I'm wondering when we as a people will, in either individually or collectively, in a fairly short period of time, recognize our need to the equivalent of a storming of the Bastille, a kind of an explosion of our humanity that decides to come out of the box. This box to me is really stifling. It's suffocating. And we're suffocating the planet. We're suffocating life itself with this obsession with commodities, protection of resources so that we can make more commodities. People so stressed out with credit card debt that they can't even pause to re-examine their life even for a couple of minutes because they're so busy trying to survive. And yet, what is the survival leading to? So I have this faith that we are able and capable of having an explosion of our consciousness, call it a quantum leap, if you will, as an alternative to the suicide of extinction, which seems reasonably a reasonable outcome if we continue doing business as usual now. It's kind of like a no-brainer, and yet how do you break the cycle? And I think that perhaps Bush is a cosmic gift in disguise. He makes it so easy, or he makes it easier to detect problems with this model that we have. He has unmasked the language and calls us. He even says to the Iraqis who are shooting and killing U.S. soldiers, come on, kill us. He's the president, acting as president, urging people to shoot at U.S. soldiers. I just can't conceive of having this kind of person as commander-in-chief of the most powerful, the most imperial military in the world. It seems surreal to me. It seems almost unbelievable. But then again, we live in a make-believe society. And the question is, when will we decide? When will we choose to say, I must begin climbing out of the box because my humanity has been stifled long enough. And I know that my well-being, as I have defined it, has been dependent upon exploitation all over the planet, hurting many people. I lost 50 friends in Nicaragua to the Contras. I lost 15 friends in El Salvador to the death squads. I get the calls. Jose was killed last night. And after a while, you wonder, if you're a clergy person, you might say, when is God going to balance the books? When is the accounting going to happen? When is the responsibility going to be felt in this culture? When are we going to become real? When are we going to actually decide that we have to revolt from a system that is so destructive that it's going to cause our own demise, our own demise? I believe that since it's such a critical issue in contemporary political terms, the issue of Korea, and that really most people in the West don't understand this history, this assault on the Korean psyche. And maybe people will recognize that there's a lot of pieces of history that have been assaultive, that come back to us. And if we can start grasping the essence of what we've done in Korea, we certainly should have known what we did in Vietnam, although people still aren't willing to talk about the fact that we invaded Vietnam. We illegally intervened in Southeast Asia. It was not a noble war. It was a criminal war that killed 5 million people. And 400 interventions in our history, overt, at least 400. And maybe 10,000 covert interventions since 47. So I'm just hoping that one aspect of the revolutionary process is more awareness of this history and the patterns of this history that have led to a George Bush who can be so cocky to say we're now going to basically control the world and the world's resources, and whoever gets in our way, we'll blow them away. I mean, we've had that policy for a while, but it's never been laid out that explicitly, that openly. And if you love it, like some of my own relatives love, who drink beer and watch television and say, nuke them all. I think, boy, I went to church with these people. I went to school with these people. We had picnics together. How could we have such a different take on the world? Well, they've never left home. I left home at the age of 20. Is that what it takes? I mean, I just heard a statistic the other day that only 5% of the U.S. citizens have passports. Is that possibly true? That only 5% of the population have traveled to another country? I don't know. That was a statistic I saw. We're very insulated. We're very spoiled. We're in denial. And my hope is that we will have a desire. Maybe it's a hope against hope. That we will have a desire as never before to find our humanity and to say to the world, we're sorry. We're sorry for all we've done to inflict this pain and this misery, and begin wailing, if you will, in tears. Because when you realize what you've done that has been so painful, you do cry, as I have cried many times in 34 years since I was in Vietnam, for having committed so much harm from so much ignorance, and to realize that my whole civilization is built on killing the indigenous, killing Africans, and then killing people all over the world that were in the way of our getting what we wanted on our terms. It's quite a history. It's not a sustainable history. It's not a sustainable model. And I'm interested myself in living in a sustainable world. So I'm hoping that all of us will recognize the need for our own quantum leap, our own revolution, if you will, of consciousness that will carry us with our imagination and with courage in places that we can't imagine at this moment, but that will liberate us from our own box. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a talk given last month in Los Angeles by Vietnam veteran and peace activist Brian Wilson. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse for that recording.
We watched the bombing on the evening news through the flickering light. coming in the name of liberty. And in between each gruesome clip, a brand new face will light the screen to sell us a new car or some shiny lipstick and to wash our conscience clean. Down on Wall Street where the money grows, suits our marketing the earth, driving around town in their fancy new cars, bearing out much they are worth. Corporate people and corporate life, sky. But this is just the way it's gotta be. Can't you hear their lullaby? Everything's fine. Everything is okay. Don't you worry.
Next, we're going to hear from a Korean-born scholar of international relations about approaches to the issue of North Korea and nuclear weapons. The interviewer is Mike McCormick.
My name is Han S. Park. I'm a professor at the University of Georgia, professor of international affairs, and I'm also the director of the Center for the Study of Global Issues at that university. And I've written books on North Korea, most recent one being North Korea, The Politics of Unconventional Wisdom, based on my numerous trips to that country in recent years.
Currently in the media, we're seeing coverage of North Korea tied into the possibility that North Korea has nuclear weapons, yet the coverage seems to be totally void of any context of the history of Korea. I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of what is missing from all of this.
Right. In the context of the controversy surrounding North Korea's nuclear program, we have to have some knowledge about the history. Where does this come from? Many people are puzzled by the fact that a country as poor, as desperate, as isolated internationally, and still has such military preparedness. I believe North Korea has nuclear bombs and has a full ability to produce without importing any parts or relying on foreign technology. So you have to, in history, you have to think about Japanese occupation period, which ran from 1910 to 1945. Kim Il-sung was allegedly, I think there's some truth to that as well, was a national leader, and he was a guerrilla warfare leader in China, Manchuria, during that period when he was quite young. I read his autobiography. Repeatedly, he shows his amazement at the might of nuclear bomb that made Japan, the Japanese Empire, surrender instantly. So he developed intense desire to develop that very weapon so that no one can interfere with North Korea. So that intense desire was carried on to his policy when he assumed the power in 1948. For, you know, he died in 1974, so it's a long time span. Consistently and persistently, he pursued a nuclear program with the Chinese help, with the Soviets' help. So they did develop the indigenous capability. So it's very difficult to curtail North Korean nuclear program with the external pressure. With that background, then we have to assess how can we control North Korean nuclear program. Since it's indigenous, it's very difficult to control it by way of blocking technology or material being imported to North Korea. It's going to be very difficult and very difficult to monitor the operation or activities on a nuclear program. So with this, then we must realize that how come a country such a poor and isolated is capable of developing this weapons and as well as military preparedness? And I think you have to put yourselves in North Korean shoes. They are really up against the wall. We're talking about an ordinary, North Korea is ordinary system in many respects, a system that is against the wall and that has lost all allies. The Soviet Union disappeared, China changed, Eastern European allies all gone. And whereas in South Korea, the security alliance, the United States, Japan, and South Korean alliance intact, even strengthened with ever-sophisticated weapons presence in South Korea, coupled with periodic joint military exercises. So they have developed intense fear, and they developed a sort of mentality or mindset that might be called a siege mentality. So they are very fearful of their existence. They think they are threatened and they can be attacked anytime. In fact, if you look objectively, their fear is very justified, psychologically as well as physically. And that is the American administration under George W. Bush presidency now defined North Korea as one of the axis of evil countries. Right now, Iraq is gone, destroyed. I mean, the United States destroyed Iraq, and Iran and North Korea may be next targets. So North Korea is very mindful of that. I personally visited North Korea perhaps about 35, 37 times during the mostly period of the 90s. Last time I visited was less than 2 months ago. It was during the Iraqi operation and toward the end of the Iraqi operation. So North Korea saw the demise of Iraq as a result of American military deployment. North Korea had a reason to be fearful of the United States military policy. So given that, in order to survive, you know, in the part of the regime, they're not going to give up a weapons program. The question how to curtail North Korea's weapons program. You have to put yourself in North Korean shoes. What might be enough incentive for North Koreans to consider reducing or even doing away with the weapons program? It's going to be very difficult unless you assume that North Korean leadership will do it despite the possibility of being collapsed. Then they might do it. But that assumption is a very, very shaky assumption. No regime would undercut its own existence. So it's going to be very difficult how you resolve it. I guess the Bush administration is contemplating on applying military pressure. At this time, economic and other diplomatic pressures. I personally think that economic sanction, blockade, all these sanctions, short of the military, are not going to work because they have been sanctioned to the bone for the last 5-10 years, resulting in part because of that mass starvation and mass death. If a country will collapse because of economic difficulties, North Korea would have collapsed many times over. A country doesn't collapse because of economic difficulty. It does collapse if it has legitimacy crisis for the regime. But North Korea doesn't. The leadership enjoys full legitimacy from the people. So, in fact, we don't have a whole lot of pressure instruments, that is, With what can we pressure anymore? They're not trading with other governments. They're not importing any spare parts. What can we do, you know? And we're talking about blocking their drug imports or dealings and counterfeit and missiles export and all that. That's much more symbolic. We don't know the volume of it, and I think the volume is very minimal in terms of the amount of money generated from that, and that sanction is not going to be influential. It's not going to press North Korea enough. And of course, the Bush administration is contemplating on attacking using surgical military strikes. That is never going to work because North Korea is no Iraq. It has a very formidable military preparedness. And North Korea's military buildup was made or has been made at the expense of enormous amount of sacrifices in the area of economic development, the human sufferings, and so on. In other words, their weapons are much more precious, or at least regarded precious, than we think weapons in other countries. So they're not going to see, in my opinion, sit down and just witness the dismantling of their weapons by surgical strikes from the United States. They will have every incentive and motivation to use those weapons before too late. Even after a few surgical strikes, they will have enough retaliatory capability. So, you know, given the proximity of Seoul, South Korean capital, with 12 million people living in South Korea, that's within 35 miles range. In any kind of all-out war or confrontation would mean millions, literally 4-5 million South Koreans killed. And of course, of 37 some American troops. So the Bush administration should be thinking about these ramifications, implications of such an option, military strike. So that leaves only one option. You have to resolve this issue peacefully. Or else the United States and other parties should be prepared to accept nuclear North Korea. So either allow or accept nuclear North Korea or peaceful resolution.
Now, what would be the steps towards peaceful resolution?
I think what North Korea wants is very clear. People are saying that they cannot understand North Korean behavior, and I do understand North Korean behavior. It's not very hard to understand. They want security assurance, and very specifically, they want to conclude the Korean War. And with all reverence for critics out there, and I agree with North Korea, there's no reason to prolong this armistice agreement or truce, temporary ceasefire situation beyond 50 years. There's absolutely no reason. There's no Cold War anymore. There's no military confrontation anymore here in this part of the world. So because of the presence of the Korean War still lingering on, you have a military buildup in both sides, either side of the DMZ. And I think it's a totally waste of resources and unnecessary. So we have to terminate that. That termination process involves only the United States and North Korea because they're the ones who signed on the armistice agreement. And that's what North Korea wants initially. And then they want more regional security regime or peace regime. And I think that's a proper thing to do. However, the United States wants North Korea to give up weapons of mass destruction unconditionally. I think that demand from the non-proliferation treaty, from the IAEA point of view, is justified. However, North Korea and the United States relationship is not a normal relationship. They're adversarial, they're enemy relationship. Now, actually, we're looking beyond, looking at North Korea from American point of view, beyond the border. The enemy. and telling them, you give up your weapons program. While we have all kinds of arsenals, weapons, they're not going to be persuaded by that. And if they say, yes, we'll give up, I mean, they may say, for political, economic reasons in international politics and so forth, but to believe that they're telling the truth is utterly naive. So you've got to alleviate this armistice agreement situation, replace it with some sort of peace arrangement first. The fact is, America is a powerful country, and we have some underlying premise difference. Americans are not saying exactly this, but their mindset is that, hey, we're different, we're stronger, we're the richest country in the world. We're not on the same footing. The North Koreans, you have to tell what we want you. Then you'll have all these lollipops and all these economic aid and so forth. If you're going to survive, you better be nice to us. And that's the American mentality. And North Koreans are uncomfortable with that. They like to see, you know, yeah, we may be poor and all that, but we are a sovereign state. So, you know, when it comes to defending the country and insisting on national sovereignty, we're equal. So you have that underlying premise difference. Americans are not going to give North Korea what they want, that is dismantling the weapons program, but insist on giving up the weapons program first. I guess eventually, I think both sides should compromise, especially the United States. I think eventually what is likely to happen is a multilateral situation to give face saving to the United States. Within multilateral situation, there will be enough opportunities for North Korea and the United States to sit down, have caucus meetings, so substantively and actually de facto to bilateral meeting can be incorporated. That is to satisfy, say, North Korean side. So in that way, we have to find some workable solution. Outside that, you know, there's no way that we can allow military confrontation. No way we can induce North Korean collapse. You know, collapsed North Korea will be a nightmare in the region. You know, millions, literally millions of people will come out into China. That's not only economic burden, but more importantly, it's a diplomatic nightmare. And the South Korean economy and society are not going to be prepared for the absorption of North Koreans. You know, the German unification, as you see, seemingly successful, but still, you know, for more than a decade, they are experiencing some maladjustment. Still, we are witnessing that. But if you compare German unification situation with the possible inter-Korea situation here, very clearly, West Germany was relatively far more stable and economically secure and, in fact, physically larger than East Germany was in comparison with of South Korea and North Korea. So South Korea cannot bear the burden of absorbing North Korea economically, socially, political instability, unrest-wise. So collapsed North Korea is no interest for any party around this area.
I think a lot of people would be surprised to find in the armistice between North Korea and the United States that South Korea wasn't involved in that. Can you give us a sense of why South Korea isn't involved with that, and then tell us about how the concept of reconciliation is important to finding a solution to all of this?
When the Korean War was waged, it was between North Korea and the United Nations. The United Nations headed by the United States. And South Korea was not the principal party adversarial to North Korea. Legally, especially legally, and also in terms of military command power, it was the United Nations and the United States on behalf of the United Nations. And that was the history. Unfortunately, that is the legal side of it. A de facto situation, certainly South Korea cannot be left out in any kind of peace-building process. So what I'm suggesting is the legal inadequacies or legal matters should be taken care of first, changing the armistice agreement into a, some sort of peace arrangement. It's not a big deal. It's a signing on a new piece of paper. The situation will not change. To change the situation, we must involve South Korea very significantly. So we have to think about in this dual stage or two stage terms. So in South Korea, unlike previous governments, this Roh-Moo-Hyun government is prepared to accept that. You deal with the legal problem of armistice agreement. And then we all, hop on the peace train and let's work out something. That's a South Korean position, and I think it's a very good position.
It seems that currently the newly elected president of South Korea is under a lot of pressure from the U.S. that is affecting his popularity here in South Korea. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Roh-Moo-Hyun was elected by and large because of more liberal segments of population, namely the youthful voters, and much more nationalistic, much more, devoid of Cold War mentality, progressive, much more favorable perception of North Korea, even North Korea leader Kim Jong-il. Those young people elected him, and President Roh is one who did not have a whole lot of experience in diplomacy, if any, really, or knowledge about international affairs and so forth. But he became president with a conviction that we must be self-reliant, we must be more nationalistic, self-assertive, and he did the first few months, did that. But the reality was the United States pressure, the influence of the United States, especially in the economic domain, was so decisive that he could not insist on doing independent or self-reliance kind of foreign policy toward the United States. So what he did when he visited Washington for that summit meeting with President Bush, he actually gave in. He asked President Bush not to withdraw U.S. troops from South Korea, reaffirmed the strong alliance, and basically supported the Bush administration's policy toward North Korea. And that made the voters back home extremely angry. And also, that may have pleased the more conservative people in South Korea, but the conservative people are not going to vote for him. There are different kinds of people. So he is going through tremendous difficulties right now. I might add that he was wrong. He should have gone to the meeting with President Bush. He should have told him that I was elected president, and just like you are, my primary obligation is to protect my people's lives and their property. And I'll do everything. That's what I'm for. I'm mandated by that, my voters. I owe them. And any kind of war, confrontation on the peninsula, will mean that millions of people will be killed. I cannot tolerate that. And the possibility of war can be by the initiation of the United States, most likely by the initiative of North Korea, but that's unlikely. So if any language of using military or surgical strike or any kind of military exercise will certainly mean retaliation from North Korea, and North Korea is militarily strong enough to do something, unbearable damage to my country, that is President Roh's country, and therefore I cannot go along with your military option. You have to understand. Please understand, I cannot condone that. And if you have to go military, I have to distance myself from you. He should have said that, and I think would have been very persuasive argument, and he would have a lot of support even from American legislators if he did that, because that's a commonsensically so persuasive argument. I don't think he did. So, you know, his presidency is still very young, and I think he should try to establish an identity for his foreign policy orientations. And I think it's still too early to judge. The problem is he cannot afford a trial error situation. This is not apprenticeship. This is a real thing. He is the president. So I really hope that he and his brains, the think tank people, will put their heads together and come up with a very rational and persuasive policy, which may or may not, most likely, may not be consistent with George W. Bush's policy toward North Korea to a large extent. But that's what, you know, post-war, Cold War era calls for. Every country will become more self-reliant, more insistent on national interest, because the world is not going to be ordered by domination that is hierarchical order. It will be more mutually interdependent situation. I think South Korean president must be mindful of that, must be more insistent on assuming initiatives in handling the Korean crisis.
How do you see the current talk in the U.S. about pulling back troops away from the border between North and South? Do you see that as a destabilizing move?
And I think that move, the real intent, I don't know. Any speculation may be plausible, but the perception is that the Bush administration, especially the Defense Department, Rumsfeld and his people, may be thinking military strike seriously, maybe removing potential targets in the form of American military personnel away from the harm's way. And that very thought, perception, is very dangerous because North Koreans, I'm certain, that are led to believe that. This is a part of their preparation to attack us. You know, North Korea is no Iraq or Afghanistan. The United States, months ago, they assembled more than 200,000 soldiers there in Middle East, you know, surrounding Iraq, and then all kinds of bluffings and so forth, you know. If you did that, the North Korea will preemptive strike. Because if they are destroyed, they lose most of the capability to counterattack. So in this case, the troop movements from the front line back and perhaps some partial removal of ground troops from South Korea, that would be interpreted by North Koreans as a part of war preparation. And I think it's very dangerous. That can trigger North Korean action anytime.
What would be, if you could deliver a message to citizens in the U.S., what would be your recommendation for what they should convey to their leaders in Congress?
I think the United States, the tragic fact is that North Korea is not known to the American public. And what they know is largely distorted and wrong. I've been an American citizen for 40 years. I know America fairly well. And I know North Korea and South Korea very well. The American public has the right to know world affairs, in this case, North Korea. And I think it's basically journalists and reporters and people who are involved in opinion making in the United States. It's their obligation to try to go into North Korea, bring them out, and read the material, and directly, indirectly, try to ascertain as closely factual information as possible, and tell the American people, this is North Korea. North Korean Kim Jong-il, I don't have a love affair with him, But he's no Saddam Hussein. He hasn't mass murdered his own people. I mean, Saddam Hussein, too. I don't know for a fact. But that's what we have been told by U.S. establishment. But what we know, what we are told about Saddam Hussein is correct, then Kim Jong-il, I can tell you, is no Saddam Hussein. So he's respected by his people. And in North Korea, there is no power conflict. There has never been. After Kim Jong-il, there will be no potential individual or groups to succeed him. So President Bush is talking about regime change. Once labeled North Korea as an axis of evil, as an evil country, then the only fate in biblical sense, in Christianity, the only fate for evil is death. So in fact, Kim Il-sung is very dangerous in this sense. George W. Bush is not ruling out regime change at all. And I think he's more interested in regime change, uprooting some evils, than doing something with the weapons of mass destruction. Clearly it was seen. You know, American troops didn't go in to hunt for weapons of mass destruction. If they did, they would have done it very convincingly, if Iraq had the weapons. But went in there to depose, to destroy Saddam Hussein's regime, which it did. But in North Korean case, regime change is going to be close to impossibility. It's going to be very difficult to eliminate Kim Jong-il, and even more difficult to handle the aftermath. So the American government needs to have whole new policy toward North Korea. The same jacket cannot fit there. So the formula that seemingly militarily successful toward Iraq and Afghanistan. Hey, who would be surprised by the fact that the United States military militarily, physically destroyed Iraq and Afghanistan? It's not a big deal. The battle was won by the United States, but the war is still being waged as we speak. So I like to see American policymakers and, more importantly, American public to have a much bigger perspective. You know, we're out of the Cold War era. Once we define some people around the world, leaders, as evils, then there will be no dialogue. You know, I'm a Christian. I've been told by my mentors in that religious community, you don't deal with evils. You destroy evils. Don't touch, don't talk. So I think it's very unfortunate that the U.S. Leader defined some leaders in the world as evils. And he, coming from Southern fundamental Baptist school or schooling, that's a very dangerous thing. And I really hope this axis of evil and dismantling and regime change, this syndrome will be short-lived. This is just a passing, like a summer rain. You know, I don't think this can be prolonged in international domain. And I hope, certainly hope not.
That was Mike McCormick speaking with Professor Han S. Park in Seoul, South Korea, last June. And thank you for listening to Unwelcome Guests. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Another brave